just a little bit. Reviews are good for us, especially in setting the stage for this particular period of time. Emily, good to see you home. When Moses was leading the children of Israel up out of the land of Egypt, out of bondage, he assured them that as God had promised them a certain land, that if they began to worship and serve idols, what would happen to them? Now, I need a passage. Moses told them what would happen to them. Deuteronomy chapter 4, beginning in verse 25. Moses said when you, that's where they were not to intermarry with the heathen nations, Deuteronomy 7. But if you began to worship the idols of the other nations, what will God do to you? Pardon me? All right, he'll drive you out. In Deuteronomy chapter 8, he also told them that in the passage, Bruce, you might be referring to. All right, we're going to look at Joshua 23. Hold that. Let's get them in the sequence here of Deuteronomy chapter 28 through 30, where we read of the blessings and the curses. And in Deuteronomy chapter 30, Moses told them what? When you worship and serve idols, and then when you turn, what will God do? He will bring you back. When you keep the commandments, statutes, ordinances, etc., which are commanded in this book of the law. Underscore that in your mind. Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 10. It tells us that Moses is obligating them to return to the commandments, statutes, and ordinances contained in the book of the law. That is, to keep the law of Moses. Now, their restoration is what he's speaking of in Deuteronomy chapter 30. Now, Moses was privileged to view the land from Mount Nebo. Where do we read about that? Deuteronomy 34. Very good. You're close. Deuteronomy 34, toward the end of that, well, actually, it's a very short chapter. The beginning of that chapter, down into about verse 4, I believe it is, where Moses died and the hand of the Lord buried him then on Mount Nebo. Moses was privileged to see the land which God sware unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Note that in your mind, because the promise being made unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is crucial when we're looking at the fulfillment of the land promise. Now, again, very quickly, where did God make that promise to Abraham? That's right, Genesis chapter 12, to Isaac. Genesis chapter 20, well, again, to Abraham in 22, to Isaac in Genesis 26, and to Jacob in Genesis 28. That's right. Genesis 22 is where God told Abraham to offer his son and renewed the promise unto Abraham. Now, coming forward just a little bit, Moses died on Mount Nebo. God buried him. Deuteronomy what? 34. Thank you. As we begin the book of Joshua, what was Joshua's responsibility now? To lead the people into the land which God had promised unto the Father. Look at Joshua chapter 1, Carolyn, and read for me verse 6, please. Joshua chapter 1, verse 6.
Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them.
All right, who were their fathers? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. These were the specific promises that were made, the land promise in particular being referred to here, as God speaks to Joshua. Joshua is to be strong, be of good courage, for you will be the one to lead them into the land that I promised unto their fathers. Now, either Joshua did or he didn't. You're talking with a premillennialist about whether or not the land promise has ever been fulfilled. You want to note who it was that would fulfill that promise. God said to Joshua, you will lead them into the land. The land that I promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to the fathers. So now we know what land. We've got the borders of that land defined for us. Where? What text? When God spoke to Abraham, where was it? Genesis 15, very good. God identified the land from the river Euphrates to the river of Egypt. That's right. We read of the Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Perizzite, the Girgashite, the Jebusite, the Canaanite. These were the people who then inhabited the land. And that was the ites that were to be driven out of the land. Deuteronomy chapter 7, Lynn, is your passage on that. Now, coming forward into the book of John, we read the first city to be conquered in the land of Canaan. What was it? The city of Jericho. Very good passage. All right, let's go forward just a little bit. Joshua chapter 6. Joshua chapter 6. Now let's put it in reverse just a little bit. We want to back up to chapter 2. That's incorrect. I'm thinking Judges. Let's stay at chapter 6. When we look at Joshua chapter 6 with the conquering of the city of Jericho, we note that there were conditions attached to the conquering of that. Conquering the city, they were to march around once each day, of course, for 6 days. On the seventh day, march around seven times. The priests were to blow on the ram's horns. The people were to shout. What happened to the walls? They fell down flat, and every man went up straightway. Judges chapter 7, Ken. What happened in Judges? I'm stuck on Judges. What happened in Joshua chapter 7? All right. All right, we've got all kinds of trouble. They were not successful in taking the city of Ai. What was his name? Achan was the man. And what did they do with Achan? They killed him. His family, everything that he possessed was to be destroyed. And they call that place the Valley of Achor. Joshua chapter 7. Now, when you continue studying from Joshua chapter 9, 10, and 11, we read of the conquering of the land. Joshua goes in and conquers the central portion, then goes down into the southern portion where he has made an alliance. Who did he make the alliance with? The princes did. He had to honor it. Pardon me? Gibeonites. That's right. And there were certain kings that opposed the Gibeonites, and so Joshua went with his army down into the southern portion then and delivered the Gibeonites because of the alliance that he had made with them. Now, as you come forward into chapter 9, 10, and 11, what is it that Joshua has accomplished by the time you get to the end of chapter 11? All right, he's gone up north. That's right. And what is said in the last three or four verses of chapter 11? Maybe about the last verse. Took all the land. All right. That needs to be marked in your mind, in your Bible, in your notes, wherever you're making marks, okay? Joshua took all the land. What land? The land that was promised. Now, Chris, let's go forward. Fast forward just a little bit. When we go from chapter 12 on up to about chapter 20. What are we studying? The dividing of the land. That's right. The inheritance among the tribes. When we get to chapter 21, Chris, if you would please read for me verses 44, I believe it is, or is it 45 beginning? 43. All right. Thank you.
Of all their enemies stood before them, the Lord gave all their enemies into their hands, not one from the
All right? When you're reading that and studying that with folks, I know some people don't mark in their Bibles. I won't call anybody's name at all. But there are certain words that you need to underscore in your thinking as you go through that. God gave them the land. He gave them all the land. Now, what land? Which He sware unto their fathers. You see that there in the text? And what did they do with it? They possessed it and they dwelt therein. They lived in it. Thank you. Okay. All right. These are terms that you want to note because it defines the land, it defines all the land, it tells us what land, and it tells us what they did with it. Now, not one thing failed. Everything occurred that God said unto the fathers about that land. Now, when Joshua continues to elaborate with them on the land, the text that Chris is going to read for us in Joshua chapter 23, if you would please, beginning about verse 14 down through about verse 16. Okay. All right. Which they certainly were. Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Verse 14, please. Not one thing has failed. But if you worship other gods, what's God going to do to you? Destroy you. Verse 16. He'll destroy you out of this good land which He has given unto you. Now when you come to the book of Judges, chapter 2, verse 10. Chris Peters, what does it tell us? Judges chapter 2, verse 10. We've got a problem now, don't we? We've got another generation on the scene that doesn't know God. And what was it that God said that He would do to them when they began to worship and serve other gods? He would take the land. He would take the land. He would destroy them from off this good land. We're talking about a period of about 300 years. And this list that you see on the board, with the exception of one, we have it him identified, Abimelech, in the list of the judges, Judges chapter 9. He's typically used in the list of the judges, but we're going to have occasion to talk about Abimelech. He asserted himself to be a king rather than to be a judge, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. He was really not a deliverer as such, but again, we'll talk about that when we get to it. But I simply want to notice with you the list that is typically used to define who these judges were. We note, with the exception of about two of them, who the oppressors were. However, when we drop down to when we drop down in the list to chapter 12, I believe it is, Ibzan and Elon. Let me look right quick. And Abdon. We don't know who the enemies were, but we do know that these men served as judges over the people of Israel. Now, when we look at the early judges, we've noted that Joshua has given them a choice. They have not been faithful in carrying out the choice of their fathers. Underscore, another generation is on the scene. And time passes, and the people begin to worship and serve idols, and God delivers them. And I want to get past just a little bit of this. I appreciate your indulgence. As I look through these charts, I thought I had that geared up where I wanted it to be. But I obviously did not. Okay, I'm looking for my circle. Here we go. My circle. Here we go. 15 judges, about 300 years. And they went around the horn like this. They were faithful to God for a period of time. Sometimes it might have been as much as 40 years or so. I think in one instance, didn't we read, about 80 years that they were faithful to God. But eventually, they began to worship and serve idols. And as they worshiped and served idols, God brought an oppressor against them. And in time, they began to plead to God for deliverance, and God provided them with a judge. Now, one of the things that we do want to note is, as we've looked at our map of the land of Canaan, there was at least one time frame where the oppressor was in the north and there was peace in the south. There was another time frame where there was an oppressor in the south and peace in the north. So I don't want us to think that oppression had smitten all of the land at the same time and circumstances were always identical throughout the 12 tribes. That's not accurate. But what we do know is that over a period of about 300 years, they rebelled against God with this cycle. Faithfulness, idolatry, oppression, deliverance, faithfulness, idolatry, oppression, and deliverance. And it makes you wonder, why didn't they get the message? Why weren't they faithful to God all of the time? Well, we learned that they turned to Baal, which means Lord or Master. In our last study, I believe we talked about this in brief, to notice that the term Baal, though it means Lord and Master, can very well be restricted geographical to be the chief God that was recognized in that particular region. Generally held or believed to be the God that provided fertility for crops and livestock. Now, when we read of the period of the oppressors that were against them, then the question legitimately has to be asked, why didn't Baal deliver them? For example, when we come to the seventh chapter, we read of the oppression of the Midianites, and we're reading of a seven-year period where they had to hide in the caves and the dens and the strongholds, because every year when it was harvest time, the Midianites would come up and take away their sustenance. And here is the God that they worshipped who did not provide for them sustenance. 7 years in a row it was taken away from them. And so that really makes you wonder why they would see any validity in worshiping these particular pagan gods. The Asheroth, or Asherah as it's sometimes referred to. Sometimes referred to as the counterpart of Baal, the god or goddess of fertility. And these two, Baal and Asherah or Ashereth, became the focus of worship during the time of Ahab and Jezebel. And you remember the contest at Mount Carmel that we talked about in our lesson on Sunday morning, where the prophet challenged the people, if Baal be God, serve him. If Jehovah be God, then serve him. We also talked about Othniel, how that he threw off the oppression of the kings of Mesopotamia that had subdued them for about 8 years. Yes. Yes. That's right. One generation removed. But lesson point, how far are we away from apostasy? One generation. Valuable lesson. Okay? All it takes is one generation that's not taught to result in a falling away, an apostasy. Okay, and that's what happened to them. Judges chapter 2, beginning in verse 10. Now, as we continue to talk about these early judges, the Moabites, the Ammonites, and the Amalekites joined forces to oppress Israel for 18 years. Judges chapter 3, verses 12 through verse 14. Who did God select to be their deliverer? Pardon me? Ehud. Yeah, Ehud. All right, good. And Ehud delivered them from the king of Moab, whose name was Eglon. Now, one of the things that's noteworthy about Eglon is he's a fat guy, but he wasn't fat enough that the sword didn't come all the way through. Okay? About a cubic long sword, Ehud stuck him through and killed him. And, of course, then we read about verse 31, Shamgar, who delivered them from the Philistines, killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad. Chapter 4 begins with Israel, as soon as Ehud was dead, once again worshiping and serving the idols, worshiping and serving the idols. Who became the deliverer? Deborah is the next judge in the list. And, of course, Deborah gave instruction to Barak, who was to be the captain of the army of Israel. And Barak had an interesting disposition. Was he immediately inclined to go and to fight against the enemy? No. Who was the enemy? The Canaanites. The Canaanites, which we know that was a constant thorn in the flesh, it seemed like, for the children of Israel. But because Barak wasn't so willing to go unless she go with him, what was then to be the consequence? Well, they've got the army, the enemy, the oppressor on the run, but the honor of victory would go to a woman. And who was the woman? What did she do? All right, tell me the story. All right, captain of the army. All right, nailed him to the floor. That's right. And so when Barak came, it was all over as far as the... yeah, all right, that's in the next chapter, or chapter 5. Yeah, very good. Very good. Very good. Again, as we talk about the early judges, I want to discuss with you chapter 6, 7, and 8. We introduced this somewhat in our last study. And now we're talking about the Midianites. Let me get past this one. The Midianites. One more, thank you. There we go. The Midianites. Gideon would be the next deliverer. Who was Gideon, by the way? Who did Gideon think he was? Nobody, thank you. He thought he was nobody. He said in verse 15 of chapter 6, O Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is the poorest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. And Jehovah said unto him, Surely I will be with thee, and thou shalt smite the Midianites as one man. Gideon asked for a sign. What sign did he see? First. The first sign. Now, the food went up in flames. And Gideon said, I have seen the angel of the Lord. And so now he's gung-ho about fighting against the Midianites, right? No, what's the problem? Wants another sign. All right, what else does he ask for? Fleece, tell me about it.
First one is that all the ground would be wet and the fleece would be
All right, the fleece will be wet and the ground will be dry. Yeah, first.
And then the next night, the other way around.
The other way around. So he wanted two signs involving the fleece. And so did God provide them? Yes. And then what did Gideon do? Nothing? All right. Well, he's still not real excited about the task that is before him, but he does prepare an army. How big is his army? 32,000 people. Notice, if you will, he's called them from Asher, Naphtali, and Manasseh, and you see why. Because the Midianites have come into this portion to take over the harvest of the Israelites 7 years in a row. And when Gideon comes with 32,000 men, chapter 7, what does God tell him? Too many. What have we got to do? If they're afraid, go home. How many went home? 22,000. Now, John, Gideon's army is still too many. How is it whittled down? Okay, so he's wound up with an army of 300. And he arms them with spears and knives and swords and cannons and guns. And what does he arm them with? Torches and pitchers or jars, yes, and trumpets. What does he do with them? That's right. Verse 17 of chapter 7. Look at your Bible. Look on me and do what I do. Verse 18, when I blow the trumpet, I and all that are with me, then blow ye the trumpet also on every side of all the camp, and say, for Jehovah and for Gideon. Did it work? Why? Verse 21. Every man stood in his place. Powerful lesson there. Every man stood in his place. We could discuss that at some length of the importance of each one. Paul discusses that in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 as he talks about the members of the body and how that every member of the body is important. It's not identical. It has a function to do. And here we see that not all of these men obviously were identical, but they had a work to do. Every man was to stand in his place and follow the leadership of Gideon. And because they did that, what happened to the army of the Midianites and the Amalekites that you see characterized from this Transjordan area? All right, they ran away. Now, when they ran away, what did Gideon do? This gets us on down into the 8th chapter. We haven't talked about that part. He chased them. That's right. He chased them. Now, the army that Gideon has prepared, calling soldiers from Manasseh and Asher and Naphtali, what do they begin to do? See, this kind of all comes to a head over in this portion because the Midianites and the Amalekites stir things up all the way over into Gaza. So it's pretty widespread ongoing pursuit. But when... I don't want that. Let's go on just a little further. Here's what I want. The Midianites had now encamped in the valley of Jezreel, and that's where all this takes place that we're reading in Judges chapter 7. And he calls his army. Of course, I left out Zebulun in the discussion. Calls his army from these tribes. And God's desire is that the Israelites understand that it is God who fights their battles. Who told them that long, long time ago? Moses did. Joshua and Caleb did. And so this is not anything new to them. But lest they vaunt themselves. What's that mean, Randy? All right, God has whittled the army down to only 300, and God desires that they see that it is Him who has delivered the Midianites and the Amalekites into their hand. All right, so the Midianites flee, and they flee to these places where they can ford the river Jordan, and they think get away from Gideon and his army. But I want you to look at something. These men from Naphtali, Asher, and Manasseh rejoin Gideon. And what do they do with the Midianites? All right, they're chasing them. That's right. What lies before the Midianites? The river. All right, we've got folks down here from Ephraim that join in the battle. And what do? They stop them. You see, they're here. Now, what does that do to the Midianites and the Amalekites? It's bad. Look in your Bible at verse 10 of chapter 8. And let's see. Terry, would you read for me, please? Judges chapter 10, verse 8. I didn't say that right. Judges chapter 10. Judges chapter 8, verse 10. Judges chapter 8, verse 10. Thank you. All right, what does that mean? Who won? Gideon's army. All right, Gideon's army. So the Midianites and the Amalekites are stopped, and the victory is given unto Israel through the army of Gideon. Now, when we look carefully at that, that makes Gideon quite an important fellow in Israel, doesn't it? You remember back over in verse 15 of chapter 6, when Gideon says, "Who am I? I'm the least in my father's house," and so forth. But when you turn over here to the 8th chapter and pick up the reading there in verse 22, it says, "Then the men of Israel said unto Gideon, Rule thou over us, both thou and thy son's son also, for thou hast saved us out of the hand of Midian. And Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. Jehovah shall rule over you." Now that sounds real good, don't it? Jehovah shall rule over you. And then what did Gideon do? What did Gideon do? David? What did Gideon do? Things, if it just stopped right there. But it didn't stop right there. What did Gideon do? Look, if you will, at verse 26 and 27. Yes, on down into the text a little bit. 26 and 27. What did he do? All right, let's look carefully at that. Gideon says, I don't want to be your king. There's one king, and that's God. That sounds wonderful, doesn't it? But as a result of this great victory, Gideon said, bring me your gold earrings. And so they did, and they piled them all up. And it tells us that he made an ephod. What is that, Jenny? All right. Let's go just a little bit further with it. Sort of like a vest, yes. Yes, it is a garment. Who generally wore it? The priest or the high priest. That's right. And if you've got a garment that's worn by a priest that's made out of gold. And those of you who are mathematicians in the family, you do the conversion. 1,700 shekels of gold, beside the crescents and the pendants and the purple raiment and the chains that were about their camels' necks and so forth and so on. Scholars kind of vary a little bit, and I'm not exactly sure why. But I've read anywhere from 50, some sources give it. Others say 100 pounds of gold. Now, the priest who would wear this garment have a hard time wearing 50 pounds of gold, wouldn't you? I would. Now, some have speculated as to why Gideon made that thing. Did he assume the role of priest between the people and God? Well, we don't know. It doesn't tell us. But he made a garment that priests wear, an ephod. And what did the people do with it? Jenny, now that's your cue. They came to see it and they lusted after it. They did. And they, in essence, made an idol out of it. What do you think about that? Did you know that little bit of information? We talk about Gideon and what a great fellow he is and all of that, but sometimes we don't get that rest of the story, as Paul Harvey says. What do you think about that? All right. Okay. That's true. Notice that little expression in verse 27, that it became a snare unto Gideon and to his house. Tell me about a snare. Some of you know about such things. Yeah, Donna, tell me about a snare. All right. So this thing that Gideon made became something that he got caught up in, didn't it? It became a snare to him and to his house. And we want to see how that played out. In verses 29 through verse 32, we know that Gideon had a whole lot of sons. How many? 70. 70 sons. And it tells us he had many wives. And his concubine that was in Shechem, she also bare him a son and called his name Abimelech. Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age and was buried in the sepulcher of Joash's father in Ophrah of the Abrizites. Now, once Gideon is dead, notice verse 33, that Israel turned again and played the harlot after the Balaam and made Baal-Berith their gods, and they remembered not Jehovah, verse 34. Neither showed they any kindness to the house of Jerubbaal. Who's that? Gideon, who is Gideon, according to all the goodness which he had showed unto Israel. Now, Gideon is not as popular now as he was. Now that he's dead, people forget all about him. And they've also forgotten all about God. And they're worshiping idols once again. But he has a son through a concubine whose name is Abimelech. Now, as we mentioned a while ago, we've got Abimelech's name listed in the list of the judges. But he was really not a deliverer of any kind. In fact, he was a wicked son of Gideon who declared himself to be king. Well, now, if you're going to declare yourself to be king, when you are the son of a concubine and there are 70 sons of wives, what do you do with this pecking order thing? You've got to eliminate the pecking order. That's right. And so what is it that Abimelech does to his half-brothers? All but one, he kills them. All right, well, that's not very good, is it? That's not very good. Well, when we get into the ninth chapter, we read some more about that. And we know that Abimelech is declared then king. Who's this brother that is spared? Jotham. Jotham. Now, Jotham is an interesting fellow. It tells us that he, well, I've called it in my notes, that he declares a prophecy. It becomes a prophecy in verses 8 through verse 20. And in it, he sets forth kind of a story or a parable, if you please. And what is the parable? Ken? He talks about three, well, basically trees, an olive tree, a fig tree, and a vine that are asked to be what? Rulers. Rule over us. Well, the olive tree kind of had a lofty responsibility. He said, can I leave my fatness wherewith by me they honor God and man? I'm reading in verse 9 now. To go to wave to and fro over the trees? Well, no. Verse 10. And the trees said unto the fig tree, come thou and reign over us. But the fig tree said unto them, should I leave my sweetness and my good fruit to go and go to wave to and fro over the trees? And the trees said to the vine, come thou and reign over us. And the vine said unto them, should I leave my new wine, which cheereth God and man, and go to wave to and fro over thee? Well, now, these honorable trees and the vine would not do that. They had something more important to do than that. So then, who did the trees go to? Bramble. What do you think about a bramble? Kind of a weed. Yeah. Tumbleweed. All right. What do they call those things? Russian thistles. All right. Well, that's not good either. So they go to the bramble. And they say to the bramble, come thou and reign over us. And the bramble said unto the trees, now verse 15, if in truth ye appoint me king over you, then come and take refuge in my shade. And if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. Now therefore, if ye have dealt truly and uprightly, in that ye have made Abimelech king, and if ye have dealt well with Jerubbaal, who's that now? Gideon in his house, and have done unto him according to the deserving of his hands, for my father fought for you, and adventured his life, and delivered you out of the hand of Midian, and ye are risen up against my father's house this day, and have slain his sons 70 persons upon one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of the maidservant, king over the men of Shechem, because he is your brother. If ye then have dealt truly and uprightly with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice ye in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and the house of Milo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from the house of Milo and devour Abimelech. And Jotham ran away and fled, and went to Beer, and dwelt there for fear of Abimelech, his brother. Now, not everything that is going to occur always occurs tomorrow, does it? What happened to Abimelech? What appears to be somewhat good, we might think. He ruled. That's right. He ruled. For 3 years, things appeared to be good. But now we've got a man whose name is Gaal, the son of Ebed. And he came with his brethren and went over to Shechem. The men of Shechem put their trust in him. And what does he tell them they need to do? Get rid of Abimelech. Get rid of him. And he issues a challenge. Verse 29, look at your Bible. It says, and should that this people were under my hand, then would I remove Abimelech. And he said to Abimelech, increase thine army and come out. What's What's that sound like to you, Ken? A dare, a challenge. Come out and fight me. What did Abimelech do? Verse 34. He came out. Yeah. And what happened to Gale? He didn't do so well. No, he didn't do so well. He was killed. And then if you read just a little bit further about the city of Shechem, where Gale has called upon these Shechemites to come out and fire Abimelech as their king, what did Abimelech do to their city? Pardon me? Well, it tells us in verse 45 that he fought against the city, and he took the city and slew the people that were therein, and he beat down their city and sowed it with salt. What did he do that for? Oh, he wanted to kill it graveyard dead so nothing would grow. And that's what he did. Now, as you look in the next portion of this chapter, it says, when all the men, verse 46, of the tower of Shechem heard thereof, they entered into the stronghold of the house of Eliber, and it was told Abimelech that all the men of Shechem, they're gathered there in that tower. And what did he do? All right, he burned it down. And so what happened to all the men of Shechem and the women of Shechem? Well, they all died. And then Abimelech went to Thebez. You see that in verse 50. And what did he do to them? All right, he burned their tower down. But there was a woman up there on that tower. And what did she do to Abimelech? Threw a millstone on his head. And what did it do to him? It cracked his skull. It didn't kill him, but it cracked his skull. And what then did he want to be done to him? His armor bearer to kill him. And so he did. He killed him. And in verse 50, pardon me? That's right. He didn't want it to be said that a woman had slain him. Now look at verse 56. It says, thus God requited the wickedness of Abimelech, which he did unto his father, in slaying his 70 brethren. And all the wickedness of the men of Shechem did God requite upon their heads, and upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal, or Jerubbaal. Who's that now? Gideon. I can say Gideon a lot easier. So he's been avenged, hasn't he? Just like Jotham said that he would. Even though it appears that things have gone quite well for Abimelech in declaring himself king, he presented himself more of a problem than he did a savior to the people at all. And it necessitated his death as he was killed by his armor bearer. All right, we'll stop with that. Be prepared to start with, if you would please, with chapter 10, next time, and we'll pursue further through the period of the Judges. You might like to do some reading about Jephthah. I don't anticipate a lengthy discussion about Jephthah because it won't take me long to tell you everything I know about that. And we'll pursue then Sunday morning.